This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you catch up on the headlines from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, February 5th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. About one in five American renters are behind on rent payments. That's according to new data from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Federal money meant to help people who have lost income due to the COVID-19 pandemic stay in their homes has often not reached those who need it most. WESA's Kate Giammarisi and Public Source's Rich Lord looked into this issue and are here to explain more. Thanks to you both for being on the show.
Thanks, Liz.
Great to be here.
Millions of dollars have been set aside for rental relief, and there have been eviction moratoriums at both the state and the federal level. So, Kate, why are we still seeing people evicted for lack of rent payment due to lost income because of the pandemic?
Well, Liz, you may recall we talked about this issue a little bit last year, that the order in place by the CDC is not ironclad. It's a bit of a patchwork. It does not apply to every situation, and locally, different district judges interpret it differently. I would also say, you know, it's preventing a lot of evictions from happening right now, but I would also add that, you know, cases are still being filed, and we highlighted one of those cases in our story.
Do you want to talk about that case a little bit?
Yeah, we spent some time with a father named DeJuan Davis, who had some ups and downs job-wise over the last year, and he fell behind on his rent, as many people did. He applied for rent relief but was denied. He's not exactly sure why he was denied rent relief. He then struggled from August through December to try to get caught up on his rent, and in fact made more than $4,600 in rent payments over those 5 months, but never got caught up. And very early in January, his landlord filed a notice to have him evicted. Now that is in the courts, although the hearings on all of these cases are being postponed for now. And he's trying to figure out a way to get current or to fight the eviction.
The state got $150 million for rental assistance from the feds, but they only used about a third of that to help tenants. Kate, Why didn't they use all the money, and where is the rest of that money?
Well, so that money that was set aside last year, that was federal CARES Act money. It was part of a couple of billion dollars that the state got, but it was set aside for rent relief. And let me just also say a little bit about kind of the importance of rent relief, which hopefully the article highlighted this, but we have this just kind of big picture situation that the government had said, we have this extraordinary public health situation that necessitates we keep as many people housed as possible, because people being pushed out of their homes into homeless shelters, being forced to double up, will spread the virus. But in order to make that work, if the government's telling people, hey, landlords, you really shouldn't be evicting anybody, I think the government was kind of acknowledging here, we have to do something to help out landlords. We have to kind of attempt to make them whole. And that is the whole purpose of rent relief, is to kind of help with that. So anyhow, to your question, the state last year set aside $150 million, but only ended up spending about a third of that on rent relief. And as the article highlights, it just seems that the way the program was set up had too many bureaucratic hurdles. It required too much paperwork, and it had too many constraints to be able to get that money out the door quickly to the people who needed it. And so the balance of that was used to plug the state's budget holes, and it went to the Department of Corrections to balance the budget at the end of the year when it was not all spent.
Now, Rich, I understand that Allegheny County kind of decided to go rogue from the state program. Why did they make that decision, and how did it work?
For the first few months of the program, which started in July, the county was trying to fund some of the tenants through the state program, which had a lot of rules attached to it, and some of them through a separate county pot of money, which also came from the CARES Act. The county was able to spend its money differently than the state rules allowed. It decided that it was going to increase the caps for the amount of rent it would pay. It decided it would help with utilities. And of course, in order to do that, it couldn't spend the state money. It had to spend its own money. But by about late October, that process was so slow. The county had only approved around 10% of the applications it had received that it just decided, you know, to heck with the state program, to heck with the state money and rules. We're really going to process them entirely through our own system and just try to get that money out there. So from about late October until the program closed at the end, close to the end of the year, the county increased the percentage of applications it was able to fund. It started out, as I said, at 10% in late October, and by the time it closed, the county had paid around half of the applicants that it had received.
Okay, so another $850 million is coming for Pennsylvania landlords and tenants. Kate, can you talk about what efforts are in the works to try to make sure this problem doesn't continue with the new round of funding?
Well, so I would say pretty much every elected official that we spoke to their credit, you know, acknowledged that the first round was imperfect. And we heard that from Democrats and Republicans. Pretty much every individual who would speak to us, you know, realized that they needed to, this needed to be better the second time. One thing that actually makes me think that this might be better in round two is that if the state does not spend this money on rent relief, it has to send it back to the federal government. It can't do what it did last year and just plug its own budget holes. This is a little bit more constrained. So a bill that passed the state Senate last week started the process of moving those funds to be set up at a program at the state level. As of right now, as we are speaking today on Wednesday, that bill has not passed the House and not gone to the governor. But even once that happens, then it still needs, the Department of Human Services still needs to actually set up the program. And also Pittsburgh and Allegheny County will have a program that is separate from the state. So the wheels are in motion. And I, like I said, I do think there is an acknowledgement that this round needs to be better.
This story that you guys co-reported is part of a new collaborative effort that Public Source is spearheading called Tenant Cities. Rich, can you talk a little bit about the series, where the idea came from, and what you hope to illuminate through your reporting?
Yeah, the first kind of inkling came early in the year, actually pre-pandemic, early in 2020, was looking at some demographic data and saw that the city of Pittsburgh had a majority of the households renting rather than living in housing that they owned. And to me, that was kind of an interesting find, because I'd always thought of this as one of the cities in which it's pretty easy to be a homeowner. You know, you can get, historically, you could get a home pretty cheap, and it seemed like a homeowner-dominated town. But over the course of the last decade, that changed, that shifted. So the balance is now that 55% roughly of the city's residents are renting their homes. And in the many of the suburbs, there's similarly a shift towards a rental economy rather than a homeowner economy. So then, of course, the pandemic comes, and we're seeing all of these different manifestations in the rental housing market. We're seeing the eviction moratoriums. We're seeing the rent relief programs, which were the subject of our first story. We're seeing evictions filed regardless of the existence of rules or curbs on evictions that have been put in place. And now, critically important piece of the housing market just seems to be under enormous stress. We're also seeing an increase in advocacy by tenants. And, you know, one of the questions that we plan to explore is, has our government, has our society, our local civic structure, has it adjusted to this new reality that most of us don't own our own homes right now?
We'll look forward to more stories in this series. Thanks to you both for being on the show this week.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
It's time for a short break. We'll be right back.
This is Rachel Martin with Morning Edition. If you're working from home more and more these days and you've got a vehicle you don't need anymore, you could arrange to donate it to this station. It's easy for you, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support.
Visit wesa.fm/cars or call 855-905-WESA.
This week, Pittsburgh Public Schools administrators proposed closing some schools, opening others, and reorganizing the district's feeder pattern. Officials say the moves are necessary to close a $39 million budget deficit, about 4% of the overall budget for next school year. However, the school board quickly voted to table the discussion. Meanwhile, two Pittsburgh city councilors want to declare a, quote, state of educational emergency, saying that the achievement gap between Black and white students is unacceptable and that the coronavirus pandemic has only deepened the disparities. Here to dig into both of these stories are WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider and government and accountability reporter Ariel Worthy. Welcome both of you back to Explainer.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Liz.
Sarah, I want to start with you. Can you describe the changes that the district is proposing?
Right. So as you said, the district faces a $39 million budget deficit, and the district chief financial officer has said that if something doesn't change soon, the next year the district will struggle to pay its bills. And so the administration proposed a plan which would close six school buildings and then close other actual schools. I know that might sound confusing, but, you know, some school buildings operate multiple schools. So the administration has also proposed shifting the lines that determine where kids go to school. And so, you know, we would shift populations of students to other buildings. It's a complicated plan and proposal, but it was tabled, and we're not sure when the board will pick this conversation back up, but the general consensus was this was rushed and that, you know, the community hasn't had a chance to weigh in yet, and there are a lot of feelings behind school closures, and this happened within the last decade. You know, in 2012, there was a redistricting process, and, you know, people have described it as traumatic for communities. Board members were saying, we need to go to the communities first. We can't just give this plan to them and then ask them to weigh in on a plan that's already a plan. And so the administration has said, this is what we need to do. This is how we're going to eat at this deficit. The reason that the administration says they introduced this now is because by state law, there has to be a public hearing no less than 3 months before the vote to permanently close a school building. And so, you know, the district said they wanted to close one school, Wolves Lair K-5 in Bloomfield, at the end of this school year. And so in order to do that and to, you know, notify staff of layoffs there, they wanted to do that before the school year ended. And so that vote would have been in May. So because this has been held, that won't happen. Wolves Lair will not close this year. But really, this proposal was to have this public input. You know, that is state law. So it's a little confusing of legally the district did have to propose this now if they wanted to close this school. But, it, you know, board members said you didn't have to have a full plan, though. We could have asked the community for input.
So, okay. So it sounds like they proposed it on Monday. In that 24-hour period between Monday night and Tuesday night, got a lot of feedback. The board members themselves said, we are not comfortable with the way that this is working. Basically, that you made the proposal and then you're going to the community.
Correct. Yeah. The board, you know, board members said their inboxes were just flooded in that 24-hour period. And many people were confused and thought that they were voting on Tuesday to close all of these schools when that actually wasn't what was happening. So, you know, several members said this was a PR crisis and we need to better communicate with our families, which, you know, has been consistent throughout the pandemic. That's been a consistent criticism of this administration.
What other cost-saving measures has the district explored, and why do administrators say that closing buildings is the only way?
So the administration has made budget reductions in the administrative office, but, you know, in December, they, at the last minute, the administration proposed a tax increase, and that was voted down by the school board, saying, we don't think that we've made enough cuts to our budget in other places to, you know, feel comfortable putting this on the taxpayers. So at that time, the administration had said, you know, we need to reduce our capital budget, which is closing schools, and that we need to reduce our workforce and reduce programs. And at that time, Summer Dreamers, which is a, you know, summer learning opportunity for students, was on the table as a reduction, a program that they could cut to eat at this deficit. So there have been conversations, but nothing has been formally proposed in terms of other budget cuts.
Now, I want to go to Ariel for a minute. Ariel, you reported on the resolution that City Council introduced this week. What does that resolution say and what does it do?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I think it's important to point out that the resolution itself doesn't actually do anything in a legal sense. It really just makes a statement. And the stand they're taking is basically that online learning has further widened the achievement gap between Black and white students, and that they need to continue to try to close it. So in the fall, the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission gave a report about how Pittsburgh public schools have not closed the achievement gap. So counselors Ricky Burgess and Daniel Lavelle introduced this legislation, and they're the only Black members of council, and they represent majority Black neighborhoods. And so one thing that they're saying is that this online learning is not helping these students who are already behind. One of the things that they recommended in the resolution is to have elementary school age students back in the buildings doing in-person learning to kind of help with some of those gaps when it comes to like reading and math. They also made recommendations to partner with the school board and the superintendent, like the mayor's office and any other interested stakeholders, to try to get these students back in the buildings, extend school days and the school calendar year, and eliminate the wait list for early childhood education programs. So, but the main thing that Burgess really wanted to say about this is a crisis. This is something that is putting students even further behind. And one of the things he said his fear is that this will put students years behind now, where they were already lacking. This just further makes the situation worse.
We need all of us to make a commitment to educating these kids, to catch them up and get them grade level proficient. That means we're going to probably have to put them in school, you know, in this spring and keep them in school all summer long into September. And this, you know, be year-round school for the next 2, 3, 4 years. They need intensive, robust academic engagement.
Ariel, what did the school board president, Sylvia Wilson, say when you asked her about that possibility of something like year-round school?
She actually said that the school board was already kind of working on some of these things. They had been discussing a longer school year, Saturday schools, these kinds of things. This was not unfamiliar to them. I will say, however, she did say that the resolution, the school board actually found out about the resolution through a reporter. And the one thing that she did say was that, you know, it would have been nice if the city came to them, the school board first, before making this resolution publicly, and they could have maybe had a conversation about it. One thing she did point out is that the city of Pittsburgh is in a state of educational emergency, so is the rest of the country. But you could tell that she was a little frustrated about the fact that this resolution was made instead of just partnering with the school board from the beginning.
Sarah, is there an appetite among the school board and the administration for this idea of like really intense schooling to try to make up for lost time? And second, like, will that work?
So school board members have said that we need a crisis plan for when students do return to in-person learning. But that has just been proposed. The administration has not formally introduced any of those types of measures like an extended school year or Saturday schools. And it's important to note that there are, you know, 4 months left of the school year. And so if that were to happen, parents would expect to know about that soon. And so those conversations aren't happening publicly right now. The school board did write a resolution in response to this, and they were saying, you know, largely the message is we're not the only school district going through this, but in Allegheny County, Pittsburgh Public Schools is one of the only districts that has not returned students in person. You know, school board members say it's not fair to compare Pittsburgh Public Schools to suburban districts because they're much smaller, but that is the fact. And, you know, they're saying delaying this return to in-person learning was not an easy decision, but we are thinking about the safety of our students.
Thanks to you both for your reporting this week.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Liz.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
Improve your morning scroll by subscribing to WESA's Inbox Edition, our daily email that pulls together headlines from our region, state, and nation to give you all the context you need to start the day. You'll find updates from our newsroom on the coronavirus pandemic, local government, arts and culture, and the environment, as well as stories from NPR. Know Pittsburgh better. Subscribe today at wesa.fm/inboxedition.
Because of the coronavirus pandemic, a lot of us stayed home for much of 2020, which meant fewer people riding the bus and the T, and less revenue going to the Port Authority of Allegheny County. But not everyone can stay home. A lot of people depend on public transit to get to essential jobs or to go grocery shopping or bring children to daycare. Here to explain what the Port Authority found in its analysis of ridership in 2020 is WESA's development and transportation reporter Margaret J. Krause. Margaret, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, my pleasure.
One of the interesting findings was that bus ridership didn't drop as much as T ridership. How come?
Well, a lot of people who take the T are doing it for work. And so if you can work remotely, there's just way less ridership on the T. Whereas for bus ridership, even if you say, you know, maybe you can work from home, but you can't get to the grocery store without the bus. So more people who take the bus are transit dependent, which means they don't have any other way to do what they need to do but the bus.
The report also found that low-income people and people of color disproportionately suffered the impact of having to ride public transit during the pandemic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So this is from something called a Title VI analysis. It's actually, Title VI is part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And it says, hey, if you get federal money, you can't discriminate. And so it's a pretty common analysis to do. So they looked at what the ridership patterns were like and the impacts of the pandemic. And so people who don't have a bunch of money and are of color were both more likely to be on a bus that was overcrowded and also more likely to be passed up by a bus that was had met its passenger limits, which is something the Port Authority put into effect fairly early in the pandemic to try and reduce any risk to their riders. It was basically this double whammy that hit people. Now, Port Authority said that they looked at this and they made service changes in November that they say is solving the problem, and they're keeping an eye on it.
Now, obviously, fewer riders overall means fewer dollars in the budget. How hard was the Port Authority hit by the pandemic?
They took a $56 million hit in revenue. They did receive $141 million from the first round of CARES Act funding, and that was to keep service operating. CEO Catherine Kellerman has said, you know, that money's not a nest egg. We are using it to keep service going. And they also, they expect that in the latest round of funding approved by Congress in December, that legislation included $14 billion for transit agencies across the country. It's not yet quite clear exactly how much money Port Authority can expect from that. However, again, CEO Kellerman said that as one of the largest transit agencies in the country, both pre and post-pandemic, they're in the top 25. They expect to see absolutely help from the federal government.
Now, Port Authority and other transit agencies in Pennsylvania are actually facing a funding cliff in the coming years. And that's because the Turnpike Commission has in recent years funded public transit to the tune of nearly $500 million. And next year, that sum will drop to just $50 million. How is the Port Authority preparing for this?
Well, right now they say they're talking with their partners in Harrisburg. They're talking with their partners in Washington. The State House has a lot of challenges ahead in terms of where their money is going to go. So this is shaping up to be a very sticky, interesting problem. The governor gave his budget address this week. It involves tax increases, which no one likes, and a lot of increases in spending. So there's a lot of pressures in Harrisburg, and exactly where transit will fall on the list of priorities remains to be seen.
Margaret, thanks so much for your reporting.
Yep, thanks. Bye.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week, and I just want to take a minute for a special note here at the end of the show. This week marks one full year of Pittsburgh Explainer. I am so grateful to my colleagues at WESA and to our listeners for supporting this idea that I had, this idea to take the best of each week's reporting and put it into a 20-minute podcast that busy people can listen to whenever it's convenient, and they can feel informed and entertained without having to spend hours scrolling on a little screen. If you like the show, if it has value in your life, please consider giving to WESA. I truly believe being informed is every person's right, and that when we have good information, we make better decisions, building a more functional and compassionate and just society. That's why public radio is free. That's why this podcast is free. That's why we all do what we do. When journalists are supported, we all benefit. So please, if you have the means, go to wesa.fm/explainer and click on the support link right at the top of the page. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, wesa.fm, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.